Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper has a big moment in the national spotlight, speaking at last night's closing night of the Democratic Convention. Meanwhile, Donald Trump and J.D. Vance campaigned this week in Asheboro at the first outdoor rally since the assassination attempt. Republican Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson was with Trump at that rally as more unfortunate news about his past is released and as spending on the campaign by both sides is on track to set records. CMS goes back to school on Monday, and as has been the case at the start of many recent school years, they will do so with a teacher shortage. Young conservatives in the state are talking about climate change. The transit plan continues to be a hot topic, and the city's newest professional team plays their opener in front of a sellout crowd. Here to talk about those stories and more is Eli Portillo, senior editor for WFAE News. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Mary C. Curtis is columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Eric Spanberg is here. He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Morning, everybody.
Morning.
Good morning.
You're awake yet?
Well, I'm barely awake. It's been a long week of late nights. The Democratic National Convention ended last night. It was a week of Democratic stars and a few from the world of entertainment like Usher and Oprah. Usher, Oprah, Oprah, Usher. And all of the and all of the potential VP candidates had their moment in the spotlight. They saved North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper for last night in what was described as a premier slot that would bring national attention to both Cooper and the state.
Hello, America. I'm Roy Cooper, the last guy standing between you and the moment we're all waiting for. So I'm going to get right to it.
Yeah, he led into the star. He led right into Kamala Harris. How did it go for Roy Cooper?
Go ahead, Mary.
No, I think that he got a great spot and he acquitted himself well. It made sense in several reasons. One, he knows Kamala Harris's record as attorney general because they were attorneys general together. So he could speak to how she talks about going after predatory banks and all of those issues. Of course, he was one of the bridesmaids, you could say, runners up. And it showed that he actually was pretty good in the job because, Mark Kelly and others went forward. And of course, it means that North Carolina is, again, one of the battleground states. When Biden was at the head of the ticket, it looked like Donald Trump was pulling away in the polls. But right now, it looks neck and neck. They have that premier gubernatorial race, and I know we'll talk about that later. And so North Carolina had an imprint there.
Yeah, he was tasked with speaking personally about his interactions with the vice president when she was attorney general for the state of California at a time that he was attorney general for the state of North Carolina. And he kept bringing up, as others have, the fact that she fought for homeowners during the housing crisis and got the banks to raise their offer from $4 billion to $20 billion. Is that still resonating with folks, you think?
I think it certainly plays to the middle class concerns that they're trying to hammer that, you know, we are of the people, we are not elitist. That was a theme that ran through this convention. I do think it's very interesting that Roy Cooper, the governor of North Carolina, which is also home to the second largest financial center in Charlotte, was hammering away at some banks last night. So that was an interesting juxtaposition. But the other thing, Mike, that stood out to me is going back to Mary's point, I thought, you know, I don't know if he started slow, but he started out, you know, sort of with the typical elements of his speech, but it really built toward the end with that enthusiastic crowd. And when he hit that line of, I want my home state of North Carolina to stand up. And then he went through, I don't think coincidentally, pretty much every battleground state before he asked the whole arena to stand up. So, a prime spot for him.
In fact, that's exactly what he did.
Are we going to stand up and fight for Kamala like she'll stand up and fight for us? All right. If you're ready, my home state of North Carolina, stand up. Stand up, Pennsylvania. Stand up, Michigan. Stand up, Wisconsin. Stand up, Georgia. Stand up, Nevada. Stand up, Arizona. Stand up, America. Are we going to stand up? Are we going to fight? Are we going to vote? Are we going to win? You bet we are. Let's go get them.
I've never heard him on the stump before, but I've never heard him like that before. I've never heard him infused with so much energy. That's North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper. He had everybody on their feet, obviously, in advance of her walking out to make her acceptance speech. Was he effective, however, Eli, in moving people either in North Carolina or around the country who might be on the fence about who to vote for?
You know, I think that he did his job well, which was to fire people up and get out of the way. He only spoke for around 5 minutes, I think. And, you know, given how late these things go and how behind schedule they've gotten, both at the DNC some nights and at the RNC previously, I think it was kind of mercifully short, and nobody wants someone talking really long before the candidate. I do think it was interesting how, like you said, Roy Cooper's been in politics here for decades, a prominent politician, but he has not really gone out and done the fiery stump speech thing. And if he runs for Senate in 2026, he's going to have to do more of that. So, you know, maybe we're seeing some warm-up run for that. I also think he could have a prominent position in a Harris administration if she were to win.
Would it be Attorney General, since they've worked together as Attorneys General?
It wouldn't make too much sense for him to be anything else. He is Attorney General of North Carolina for 2 decades, and that's his experience with her. So I think you could see that plausibly. Obviously, we're still a long way away, but this felt in some ways like a little audition for his future.
I suppose it depends on which side of the political dividing line you're on as to which convention was the better convention. If you're a Democrat, you thought they blew it out of the park. If you were a Republican, you thought that they blew it out of the park several weeks ago. Maybe the ratings are the telltale sign. I don't know. Mary, the Republican convention got great reviews when it was on, in terms of telling their party's story and presenting what appeared to all of us to be a unified party. The Democrats appeared, however, to be even more unified and more enthusiastic, amazingly enough. You wrote about this a bit this week in your column in Roll Call. Did Democrats tell a more compelling story? Did the enthusiasm that the delegates were displaying translate through the television screen? And can we tell anything by the ratings? Because at least we don't know yet about last night. But the first 3 nights of the Democratic convention outrated the first 3 nights of the Republican convention. Donald Trump's speech pulled in 25 million viewers. We don't know how many hers pulled in yet, but answer all of those questions.
Her speech was shorter, which people might have appreciated. Her speech was shorter and more focused. I think, Mike, they told a different story and a very different one. Of course, I think there was more enthusiasm for the Democrats all together just because it's new. You thought you were going to have Biden and you had Kamala Harris. There, even though she's been vice president and she was senator, attorney general of California, there are a lot of Americans that are still getting to know her, and she wanted to define herself before the Republicans could define themselves. And you said that they were both unified, but I would take a little note of that, a disagreement with that, because the Republican convention was unified only in the sense that it is solidified as the party of Trump. If you look at it, none of their Mitt Romney ran for president. Where was he? Where were all the Republicans in their past and in their legacy and in a sense, future stars? Well, many of the Republicans were at the Democratic convention. You saw that, some Republicans saying, I am still a Republican and conservative, but the issue is democracy. Whereas in the Democratic convention, you saw an older, he looks ill, Jesse Jackson get an ovation. You saw folks like Elizabeth Warren have their place in the sun. And of course, Biden. Then you also saw this bench of stars that I think the Democrats are saying, here's our future. Wes Moore, Gretchen Whitmer, Pete Buttigieg, Max Frost, a young man, a congressman from Florida. And so I think they told a very different story. The Democrats were trying to say, we're inclusive of all of these people and all of these points of view. And the Republicans are saying, we're behind Trump, everything he believes in, that's who we are. And they even solidified it by nominating as vice president someone very much like Trump, instead of, say, going and nominating Nikki Haley or somebody who might expand the base.
Yeah, the former lieutenant governor of the state of Georgia, a Republican, made a very compelling speech against Donald Trump and for Kamala Harris. And last night, Adam Kinzinger, who was on the January 6th committee, made an even more compelling attack or indictment of the former president. I'm just curious where Liz Cheney was in all of this. Is it just a bridge too far for her?
Maybe. I mean, the Cheney family, they are the conservatives to the max, right? But she has said that she will do everything in her power not to have Donald Trump, to have to let him have another term because of the danger that she says he, is to democracy. And I thought it was a very compelling. I'm surprised they didn't do it the last night when they had the actual scenes from January 6th. Because in some ways, that's gone into the memory hole of America. Mm-hmm. Oh, what happened? Was it that bad? Donald Trump is saying they're hostages and he will pardon them. And when you saw that, and when you saw police officers getting beaten and heard them on the walkie-talkies, you know, they're breaching the Capitol, it just really brought it home what the stakes are.
Mary, you wanted to jump in here.
Yeah, I think you mentioned the number of Republicans that spoke. And I think that really speaks to the fact that, you know, we saw a lot of enthusiasm in the room amongst the Democratic delegates, but I think in many ways, this convention wasn't a play for those people. It was a play for moderate voters in swing states. And I think that was really exemplified by the number of prominent Republicans you saw appearing at the convention, and also the focus on things like veterans. Numerous Democratic politicians that were chosen were veterans of recent wars. There was a moment last night when Congressman Ruben Gallego from Arizona brought out a large group of veterans onto the stage with him to chants of USA, USA. So it really seemed to me like, and it's, I think, emotive of the way that the Harris campaign has sort of changed the tone since taking over for President Biden, which is we're going to focus on a more positive message. We're going to focus on these sort of broad themes of freedom and joy and really make a play for these moderate voters who simply don't like Donald Trump, rather than focusing on things like January 6th, this message that the Biden campaign had that was a lot more focused on sort of, you know, a little bit of a darker tone, this idea that, you know, our democracy is at risk, your safety is at risk, these bad looming threats are here in this election.
And between the January 6th video that Mary alluded to a moment ago and the fact that she, Kamala Harris, was portrayed as the law and order candidate because she is the former Attorney General of California against the felon who is running in the other party, something else emerged. And it wasn't my imagination because I was switching around last night. One of the commentators on one of the stations, I've forgotten which one it was now, pointed out that the Democrats have taken the mantle of patriotism back from the Republican Party. Do you think that's true?
Saw a lot of flags and yes, chants of USA. And they're trying to say our vision is the patriotic one, this inclusive one, because Republicans had taken that. But now, yes, it's joy. And it is, as Mary Ramsey was saying, a whole different meaning to patriotism.
Couple more questions about the convention. I know they're going to be covering this moments from now on 1A, so we'll move on to other things like Trump and Vance, who both appeared in Asheboro this week when we come back. But I have a few more questions about the Democratic convention before we move on, and we'll do that with our roundtable of reporters here on Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup when we come back. It's WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. We're here with Eli Portillo, Senior Editor for WFAE News, Mary Ramsey, Local Government Accountability Reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast, and Eric Spanberg, the Managing Editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Before we move on, One thing that happened consistently, except for last night at the Democratic National Convention, was that the key speakers, the stars, the big stars of each thematically produced night, were on well after primetime ended, well after 11 o'clock in the East. It's always been the rule of thumb in broadcasting. You want to be on in prime time in the East. That didn't happen consistently. Biden on Monday, Obama on Tuesday, the vice presidential nominee, Tim Walz, on Wednesday. They didn't make it on television in the East until after 11 o'clock. Some pundits are saying that's a terrible miscalculation, bad strategy, and bad management of a convention. But is it? Because others have said, in this world where everybody watches things the next day on their phone, it doesn't matter anymore. What's your take, Eric?
Well, I think there's certainly a lot of truth to the fact that we all watch everything on demand when we want. But I have to give a little credence to that old theory. Yes, far fewer people watch TV at scheduled times. But with an event like this, if you can get it a little bit earlier in that 10 o'clock hour, I think that's where you want it. And we all know that the majority of people are on the East Coast, and they were the ones that were forced to stay up the latest. So, yeah, I think it was a little bit of miscalculation or maybe just sloppy time management. But, you know, they did it day after day, so I don't think they were too alarmed by it.
Yeah, Mary Curtis.
Yeah, and when you ask Bill Clinton to speak, you got to make sure he has double the allotted time, which he did apparently take. They say he people who had a view of the teleprompter was saying he's off to the races, right? I do agree with Eric. They should, particularly, I think, the first night with Biden. A lot of people are saying it was because that they wanted to push him off to the side. And I don't think that's it. I think it was just they had so many of these opening speakers. I think there was also so much applause that folks got, ovation after ovation. But at a certain point, you have to start editing, trimming, and saying to some folks, you're not going to be on there. That said, I don't know anybody who hasn't watched Michelle Obama's speech over and over again, because as Barack Obama said, am I the only person stupid enough to come after Michelle Obama?
Well, I do think it's interesting, and this is up to a matter of opinion, I suppose, but I think that Michelle Obama beat Barack Obama in terms of speech making. I think Hillary Clinton beat Bill Clinton in terms of speech making. And of course, the star of the show was Kamala Harris, who delivered a knockout of the park speech. There were a couple of North Carolinians who were at this convention, one of whom we haven't heard from in a very long time. I read an article this morning about this. John Edwards was there, and some reporter caught him in a bar in Chicago. Yeah. Eric, tell me about this.
Yeah, that story just kind of really made me raise my eyebrows. There was a New York Times reporter who ran into John Edwards and a lot of his old staffers at a bar in Chicago during convention week. He's now 71, and he spoke to the reporter and said the DNC had invited him. He was excited that he had been invited, and he was just kind of, you know, giving the whole golly gee whiz. It sure is interesting to be back after 20 years. I think he said the last one he attended was in Boston in 04, which would have been when he was John Kerry's running mate. So, yeah, really surprising to see. I mean, it feels like such a bygone era, doesn't it, John Edwards?
Yeah, because today, what he was accused of doing and what, in fact, he did, and I'm not excusing it because what he did was reprehensible, and I think that he would be the first to tell you that, would not disqualify him today.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, totally. I wonder if it would be, I mean, certainly it wouldn't be a small story, but what would the scale of it be? And the news cycle moving so fast, would it be a couple of weeks and then on to something else? You don't know. But what a just surreal juxtaposition to have John Edwards attending this particular convention.
So the question is, because things have obviously changed since he was knocked out of that race, and since the former head of the Democratic Party, I can't think of his name, the governor of was it Connecticut, who said woohoo at the end of
Howard
his
Dean.
Speech, Howard
Vermont,
Dean,
yeah.
That disqualified him almost instantly. Are we better today, or are we worse off today? Have our standards dropped so far that we're worse off?
I mean, that was a pretty weird yell he did. I like to think
well,
that.
I'm sorry, though. He said that in the room, it was just the amplification, Vermont, from Vermont. But the thing is, too, he was also the person who was involved with the 50-state strategy that helped Democrats expand the map. I think the Edwards and Dean thing are in totally different categories, of course. And I do think that Howard Dean, no, that wouldn't have been as big. But remember, you know, Muskie, people thinking that he cried. I mean, think of the things that a big deal was made that Reagan was a divorce president. And now we had a president that, you know, three times, I guess, marriage.
Yeah,
and now with Kamala Harris, she and her husband, the vice president, her husband, Doug Emhoff, celebrated their 10th wedding anniversary, I believe, yesterday. Mm-hmm. And they celebrated their blended family on the stage. His ex-wife apparently was there. And that does look a lot like many families in America right now. And I think that's an acknowledgement that Americans and American families can look many ways.
Eric.
And just real quickly, Mike, I think all of those things, what Mary said, what the question that you asked and thinking about John Edwards and what disqualified him, those all reflect how much politics are of their time and of their social moment. I think that's really what it tells us.
So, Mary Ramsey, you filed a story yesterday about a woman named Emma Biggs who was arrested while protesting for child care funding at North Carolina's General Assembly earlier this summer. She spoke at a panel discussion, as I understand this, at the convention this week, behind the scenes, not on TV, about some of the things that she says Democrats should know. What were those things?
Yeah, so her message was really that the childcare industry, Emma is a preschool director here in East Charlotte, that the childcare industry, as well as the caregiving industry in general, people who provide healthcare for people with disabilities, people dealing with long-term medical issues, the elderly, are really dealing with a crisis in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. During the pandemic, there was a real infusion of grants and other government funding that really helped these businesses stay up and running, provide the services that are so vital to our economy in order to allow people to go out and do their jobs. And now that that money is being rolled back, that money is not flowing as much as it was during the pandemic, if at all. They're dealing with a real crisis in terms of being able to function. And her message to Democrats was really, you need to take this issue seriously because it could be a drag on the economy.
That was my next question, because it seems to me the Democrats are tuned into that they do take that kind of thing seriously. And I think it's come up in discussions on the floor of the convention. Certainly medical help and help for our parents came up in discussions and speeches on the floor. Was she at the right convention?
She believes so, yes. Emma told me that she was very heartened by the focus that the Harris campaign has been putting on caregiving. She said, as someone who works in that field, it's, you know, a lot of workers who often feel really unappreciated, and that it meant a lot to her to be recognized. She participated in a pre-recorded video that aired during the main convention, did not get a chance to address the convention. As you mentioned, there was some shifting around with the schedules over the course of the week because nights were going so long. But she told me that it was a really gratifying experience, and that she felt like she was really able to convey her message in a place where she didn't necessarily feel like people like her have been heard before.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump and his running mate J.D. Vance were in Asheboro on Wednesday, the focus of that outdoor rally, which was the first outdoor event, I believe, that Trump has participated in since his attempted assassination. The theme was security. He argued that conflicts like the war in Ukraine and fighting in Gaza would not have happened under his watch.
Every American was safer under President Trump. In fact, the entire world was safer when I sat behind that beautiful, resolute desk at the Oval Office.
Yeah. Of course, it's impossible to prove a negative. So is this just typical Trump blather?
Well, he talked about a lot of familiar themes. He criticized President Biden for the withdrawal from Afghanistan and the way that was conducted. He also talked about what he calls woke generals and said that they are making the military less safe by, in his words,
based on what evidence?
Based on, I think, the evidence of the quote-unquote generals who talk to him and call him sir. That's the evidence he frequently cites. Mm-hmm. He says that there's been too much focus on cultural issues in the military, and he'll get rid of the woke generals and DEI, all that. I thought it was interesting that among all of the wars and foreign policy, a lot of it kept coming back to how he feels he was mistreated personally. It speaks to, I think, this continued inability to focus on policy that we keep reading about anonymously, his advisors telling him, focus on policy, not the personal. He even said to the crowd, hey, should I focus on policy? They want me to focus on policy. My advisors, you're fired. I don't want to focus on policy. So I think there's this continuing tension where you have people in his campaign saying, focus on policy, stop with the personal stuff. And he just, yeah. It's been 9 years since he was running. He is who he is. I don't see that he can do it.
Yeah, he's a five-year-old. Trump, as politicians do, the gloves are off because there is no equivalent between what's happening today in the Republican Party and what's happening with their candidate and what has happened historically with the Republican Party and with the Democratic Party. There is no equivalence. Let's not hide it. I will not hide it any longer. Trump, as politicians do, invited several locals to be with him on the platform. This time he invited a couple of dozen of North Carolina sheriffs and Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson to be there. He's running for governor, of course. And Robinson's presence there on the platform with Donald Trump and the sheriffs led Trump to question whether the stage could hold the weight.
Just so you know, these are great people, but I want to get them the hell off the stage because I guarantee... They didn't have this in mind when they built this. Thank goodness Mark lost a lot of weight over the last couple of months. I'm very happy. You did, actually.
Just another example of a Trump tangent, but for some attendees like Joyce Baugus of Harrisburg, specifics weren't as important as the chance to see him in person.
We're real big fans of Donald Trump. And very conservative. Whatever he talks about, if it's conservative, we're ready to listen.
Now, I don't know what her definition of conservative is, but I've heard many conservatives, including many at the Democratic convention this week, say that Trump isn't one of them, and neither is the party. So is he? Are they?
Well, you know, I think that you're seeing this kind of focus on vibes, as the kids say. A lot of people have accused both campaigns of being policy light and, you know, trying to just hit the vibes. So that's been a theme. I got to circle back to the Robinson thing for a second. In the latest poll, I know we're going to talk about the governor's race, but in the latest poll that came out yesterday, he's down 14 points to Josh Stein in the High Point poll that was released yesterday. He is massively down right now. And he got on stage with Trump, the party's leader, and all Trump did was make a crack about his weight. I don't have any special insight, but that can't be what the governor's campaign really wants to see.
With
out
friends
of
like
that.
Those.
Yeah. Mary Ramsey.
Yes. So I was in Asheboro and just on the Robinson front first. I think it's also worth noting Mark Robinson was not one of the introductory speakers. He has been when Trump has been in the state in the past, but he did not address the crowd during this week's event, save for that brief moment that you played where he was on stage. And with regard to, you know, changes in the Republican Party, I thought it was interesting, you know, as someone who came of age during the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, sort of our perception of the parties was the Republican party was the more hawkish party, and the Democrats were the ones saying we need peace and we need to not use our military as much. And now Trump has really shifted, at least in the context of his supporters, the foreign policy stance of the Republican Party to a much more isolationist view. Much of his speech on Wednesday talked about the idea of, you know, we're not going to get involved in these international affairs. We're going to force, you know, European countries to pay for their own military. We're going to give, you know, peace through strength was a phrase that he used frequently. This idea that he just has such a great rapport with other world leaders that they simply won't create conflicts while he's in office. So it's, I think, a real shift even from, you know, we were talking about elections like 2004 just a few minutes ago. It's a real tonal shift in the Republican Party in terms of how they approach foreign policy. And it'll be interesting to see if that sticks in the long term or if that's simply a symptom of the Trump phenomenon.
And they both do. But go ahead, Mary Curtis.
Yeah, I just say it's interesting because of NATO, saying that we will defend NATO, as Mary was referring to, happened on the Democratic stage. And also, I thought when you heard the follower of Trump say, you know, whatever he talks about, I'm there for it. I just love the man. I think that is the danger, too. It's his plus, but his minus. Donald Trump has a ceiling and a floor. He gets about 46, 47% of the vote no matter what. and it was enough to win in 2016. He got pretty much the same amount in 2020, but he lost. And that's because more people came out to vote for the other person. And that's what they're hoping for, that Kamala Harris' excitement will bring out young people, bring out more people, excite the base. Because Donald Trump, and particularly as he goes in on the base, has a certain ceiling that he can reach of people who will love him. But, you know,
The concerns over security that they talked about at that rally, both Donald Trump and his running mate J.D. Vance, extended not just to international affairs and the military. It also went into people being in the country illegally and, according to J.D. Vance, should not be able to vote in the upcoming election.
In the state of North Carolina, we believe the only people who get to vote in our elections are the people who have a right to be here, not illegal aliens, Kamala Harris.
Of course, that, like most of everything they talk about, is a red herring. Non-citizens cannot vote in federal elections. It is not an issue. More importantly, the allegation is false. There is no record of Vice President Harris attempting to allow or advocating for people not in the country legally to vote. But North Carolina's citizenship requirement for voting amendment is on the ballot this fall as a legislatively referred constitutional amendment. A yes vote would amend the state constitution to provide that only U.S. citizens 18 or older can vote in elections. A no vote would oppose amending the constitution. This is the first I've heard of this. So why aren't we hearing more about this as we head toward Election Day? And is this amendment really necessary?
Well, it was covered when it went on the ballot, when it was approved as a referendum. I think right now there's been a lull, not too much campaigning around it. What the supporters of this bill say is that, federal law aside, there have been cities, you know, in other states that have allowed non-citizens to vote in local elections, in municipal elections. They want to ban that. Also, the RNC, the National Party, has sued North Carolina's Board of Elections, just filed a lawsuit yesterday saying that they are not getting non-citizens off the voter rolls and enforcing the law. So the Republicans are making a concerted push around this issue, and I think you're going to see them use it to drive people to the polls.
I have 30 seconds, Eli, and I'm just curious about something. We have voter ID requirements now when we vote in North Carolina, but can you get a driver's license if you're not a citizen? In other words, is that enough to prove that you are a citizen?
You know, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I do not believe so. But, you know, hey, we're on live radio. I'll say don't quote me on it.
Okay. So with regard to that amendment that we're going to vote on in November, we're not alone. We'll be joining states like Iowa, Kentucky, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Wisconsin in having voters consider similar moves. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Eli Portillo is with us, senior editor for WFAE News, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. Eric Spanberg is here. He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, and Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. It's the local news roundup. So let's see here. I think I've lost my place. Yeah, this November, voters in North Carolina will have the largest field of presidential candidates to have appeared on the ballot in the last 50 years. Seven candidates are running for president on our ballot. Cornel West and his Justice for All party just got permission to be on the ballot. He'll be there with Harris and Trump, but also Libertarian Chase Oliver, the Constitution Party's Randall Terry, the Green Party's Jill Stein, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. from the We the People Party, if he doesn't drop out sometime today. And he's considering doing that and throwing his support to Trump. So whether he stays or goes, what impact might all of these alternative choices have on the outcome who gets this state's electoral votes?
Well, if you think it's going to be another 1% margin race like the last time around, where it was, I think, 1.7%, then these could have a big impact. You know, RFK Jr., it's believed, draws votes from Trump, but also potentially from Democrats because of the last name. Cornel West, Democrats have been worried, could draw votes from Kamala Harris as sort of a left-leaning academic. And then, you know, there's kind of the Green Party, where we saw in the notorious 2000 election. So, you know, there's all kinds of permutations where a few thousand votes could really swing this thing. At the same time, you're going to see so much spending over the next 75 days or so on ads from the major parties that it's going to be really hard for these third parties to break through at all, because we're going to see a blitz like, you know, we haven't seen.
We also have a governor's race going on the ballot that doesn't seem to be very noisy so far in terms of talk and issues. At an appearance in Statesville before the Trump rally in Asheboro, Mark Robinson, who is running for governor, told WSOC-TV that if elected, he would work to bring back the death penalty, which hasn't been used here since 2006. He said he would appoint judges who were tough on crime and that he wanted to take a strong stand against gang violence.
We have to stop these gangs, and we have to come up with ways to break these gangs up before they can get into our schools, before they can get onto our streets and recruit these young people.
How big a problem is gang violence in North Carolina? I've stumped the panel.
Well, you know, Charlotte has had a lot more killings this year and last year.
But by gangs, or is it by people who know each other?
Police have generally said these are interpersonal fights that, you know, instead of fists, elevate to guns because young people have easy access to them. So we haven't seen here in Charlotte people saying that there's, you know, a huge presence of gangs driving this spike in violence.
Eric.
And Mike, let me know if I'm jumping ahead here, but are we going to talk about the money aspect of the governor's campaign? Because I think that is an important detail to get into, not only eye-popping numbers, but the disparity between Stein and Robinson. I think it's something like two-thirds or three-quarters of the money is on Stein's side and the rest on Robinson. And I think that is part of the explanation of what Eli referred to in that 14-point margin in the most recent poll, and I believe there was a 10-point margin in a New York Times poll this week. So you're definitely starting to see this race open up.
And Public Radio's Colin Campbell, our colleague in Chapel Hill, reports that both Attorney General Josh Stein and Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson are pledging to cut taxes. In fact, Robinson announced a 10-point economic plan earlier this month. And third on the list of that plan is cutting taxes for all North Carolinians. What else do we know about that? What specifically does he want to do? Do we know?
Was this on Robinson?
Yeah. Robinson.
Yeah, on Robinson, I believe he also mentioned cutting grocery taxes. Was that Robinson? And also reduction in taxation on veterans' benefits. So hitting those familiar themes, and Stein as well with his economic plan. I mean, they're both trying to hit middle class, working people, and say my economic policies will do more than the other guy. Neither one of them is particularly deep on substance. Of all the economic plans and policy recommendations that I've seen, I think the one that would probably make the biggest actual difference is the resumption of the earned income tax credit, which is something that Attorney General Stein favors.
Yeah, neither candidate, by the way, is proposing to cut income taxes, which are already at 4.5%, with decreases set to 4.25% next year and an eventual decline to 2.49%, which would be, that's a big cut, by the year 2034 if we hit certain revenue targets. Stein says his plan, which is what you just referred to, the tax credit, income tax credit, would result in an average $520 credit for working families of three or more getting a credit of up to $1,486. Now, we all buy groceries, so which would have the greater impact, Stein's earned income tax credit or the tax cut on groceries that Robinson is proposing?
Well, the grocery tax is already only 2%. That's pretty modest for a sales tax. And if you look at national and state analyses of earned income tax credits, those tend to make the most meaningful difference for working families, that they can actually tangibly see themselves gaining a little ground financially. So not that I'm an economist, but I like to pretend to be one at the Business Journal from time to time. So I'm going to say earned income tax credits would be more meaningful.
Eli.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, I think it's interesting that you're seeing candidates on both sides focusing on groceries. You know, Kamala Harris, of course, talked about groceries and what she calls price gouging and fighting that, made that a central part of her message last week in Raleigh when she was here. And, you know, I think that speaks to how, you know, ordinary people are experiencing the sticker inflation on things like grocery items so prominently, and that both parties see this as an opening.
Mary Ramsey.
Yeah, just piggybacking off of Eli's last point, I think another great example of what he was just saying in Stein's plan is he also mentioned the idea of bringing back a tax-free weekend during back-to-school season in North Carolina. North Carolina has not had that for about a decade. There's plenty of debate amongst experts on how much benefit those things actually have, both for families and for the economy as a whole. But, you know, I think that's something that could get people talking. I know I certainly remember back when it was a thing when I was a kid growing up in South Carolina, that was, you know, when we went to the mall and we got our new shoes and our new clothes and our new backpack. So it's certainly something that, again, it remains, you know, the people need someone smarter than me to figure out whether it'll have real impact, but something
that one weekend would save parents money as they buy notebooks and back to school stuff for their kids. And it would save more in Mecklenburg County than in South Carolina, because our tax rate is higher than in Mecklenburg County than in South Carolina. Speaking of going back to school, it's back to school on Monday at CMS. And as has happened in countless recent school years, they will start with a deficit of teachers. How many teachers are they short?
Right now, it's around 300, just under that. That is less, much smaller than last year, about, I think, half of what it was last year. They say that they are going to be able to manage that by shifting people around, shifting some personnel who were in kind of more specialty roles that were being paid for with federal pandemic money. Now that that money's run out, they can move some people. So they say there's not going to be kids in empty classrooms, but, you know, they're still trying to fill those as the year starts.
And CMS Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill says each school was mandated to create a plan for dealing with teacher vacancies, and made a point of saying that the teacher shortage is a nationwide problem.
We've come to grips with there will be a teacher shortage. This is not going away. It probably will get worse before it gets better.
So do we know how these schools are going to handle these shortages?
Yeah, some shifting personnel. You can also combine classes. You know, for some schools where, you know, kids are older, there's some virtual options. So they're going to cobble things together and make it work that way. Again, there's not going to be, you know, a bunch of kindergartners in an empty classroom with no teacher at the front.
And just as was the case last year, we're also short some bus drivers, though not as many bus drivers are absent as last year. Also this year, they are expanding the number of scanners that they began to install at schools in 2022 following a surge of guns turning up in those schools. They are now these scanners in all middle, high, and K-8 schools. And the number of guns coming into schools has dropped dramatically. But items like three-ring binders and rolling book bags have triggered false alarms with these scanners.
Sometimes with our scanners, we were getting false positives. So students were going through, it was slowing down the process.
So this year, those items have been banned. What? No three-ring binders? How will I live? Eric, the transit plan, moving on. The Charlotte's transit plan and the sales tax increase to support it continues to be on a roller coaster. First, it was the northern towns refusing to get on board with the tax if they didn't get a train. So now it appears they will get a train, but at the expense of Matthews, which is likely to get bus rapid transit instead of the Silver Line. And now their town board has said they aren't on board with the sales tax. But this week, because the Red Line may be coming, Cornelius Town commissioners voted unanimously on a resolution supporting the tax. This is exactly like playing whack-a-mole. Can this issue be resolved?
I'm just glad I don't have to answer the three-ring binders question. Yes, it looks like this can be resolved. And the way I think it's going to be resolved is that Matthews will be the one holdout and the other five towns in Mecklenburg County and the city of Charlotte in the next couple of weeks are all going to endorse this resolution for the sales tax. I guess I should say four towns since Cornelius has already done it. But Mike, what it looks like is Matthews is going to grouse. They're going to complain. They're going to talk about how rail in one place versus another is unfair, but I don't think they're going to get a lot of traction with that.
We're going to talk about this in depth on Tuesday on this program, but Eli, you report, this is kind of weird. This whole thing is kind of weird because the reason the plan was changed, the reason the Silver Line is probably not going to go to Matthews, is because the legislature got involved and said our plan was too rail-centric and not road-centric enough. And the people in Cornelius and Davidson and Huntersville wanted a train because they don't want to be on the roads. But you report that not only is Cornelius pleased with their rail prospects, they also like the newly modified version of the transportation plan because it would spend roughly half of the new tax money raised on roads. Cornelius town manager Andrew Grant called it a game changer for road funding, adding, "I've never seen anything like this in my career." It's that good?
Well, you know, Cornelius is expecting to get around $6 million in the first year for its roads. That's about 15% of the town's budget. If you add up what the three northern towns, Cornelius, Huntersville, Davidson, will get in the first 10 years, it's estimated to be around $200 million. I thought it was interesting. I've been watching these meetings for, I don't know, way too long. Spent a lot of my life watching transit plan meetings. And the Red Line, the trains, everything you hear so much about, they were kind of getting a perfunctory mention, and the leaders were just going gaga and gushing over the roads. So it really has become, in some ways, a roads first plan like the legislature wanted.
Meanwhile, Eric, you reported that next week, a group of local elective leaders and business executives will go to Miami for a primer on bus rapid transit, and they will go without the mayor of Matthews, the town likely to be most affected by this. Mayor John Higdon declined the invitation. He's that ticked off.
He is. And Mike, you just can't make it up. I mean, that's why you can't get to the question and I can't get through the answer. And I think what's really interesting is let's assume all this plays out. Everybody endorses and the tax is approved. So I guess they'll go ahead and build bus rapid transit for a place that doesn't want bus rapid transit. That's where we're headed.
So conservative politicians have generally ignored, poo-pooed, or fought against initiatives to thwart climate change. Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson calls climate change junk science. But this week, WFAE's climate reporter Zachary Turner did a story, Eli, on young conservative voters in North Carolina who are concerned about climate change. He went to a meeting of young Republicans. What did he find?
Yeah, so if you survey younger voters, you often find climate change is their top or one of their top issues. And that's in contradiction with, kind of many conservatives' historic stance, as you mentioned, that it's not real or it's not human caused or it's not a concern. So Zach Turner went and talked to young conservatives in Mecklenburg, and he found some interesting dynamics. People who acknowledge climate change is real and human caused, who, you know, basically are in line with what the majority of younger folks believe based on the science, and have their own solutions to it. These are largely market-based solutions, things like nuclear power. They don't want to ban fracking like you might see on the Democrat side. For example, they want to increase investments in nuclear power to move away from fossil fuels. So I think you're seeing a different dynamic emerging as the generations change and beliefs about the settled science change.
I'm curious as to, maybe you don't know the answer to this, but why nuclear as opposed to other renewable? That nuclear is not renewable, but renewables like wind and solar, et cetera.
Well, if you look at how much power a nuclear power plant can generate versus wind turbines or solar panels, they make the argument that, hey, look, we need a ton of power. We're going to need a ton more power for electric vehicles, for data centers, for population growth. And, you know, solar's nice, but they say nuclear is necessary to get the scale.
Solar doesn't work when the sun doesn't shine, and wind doesn't work when the wind doesn't blow, but they don't melt down and cause disasters.
You know, I think they would argue that nuclear does not do that very often. Okay. And if you look even at, you know, Three Mile Island, we're okay now.
So I have 1 minute left. Charlotte, we have another professional soccer team, a women's soccer team, the Carolina Ascent. And this weekend they sold out, Eric, their opening game. Got off to a really great start. Are we going to be over-soccered, though, because we got 19 soccer teams now or something like that?
We do have a lot of soccer teams, but women's sports is growing so fast, and there's such an appetite for it. I think they have a really good chance to succeed, and 10,500 fans says a lot, and we'll see how they continue that Sunday with their second home match against Lexington.
Yeah, they play 14 home games this year, 14 away games, and they'll play through, I think, what, June of next year, with a summer, with a slight winter break. So good luck to
a lot of young women
the,
playing soccer.
Yeah, good luck to the Ascent. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, Mary C. Curtis with RollCall.com, Mary Ramsey with the Charlotte Observer, and Eli Portillo, senior editor for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.